Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.
We want to bring you a special interview. ITV legendary football commentator Clive Tilsley is coming your way. He sat down with Shane Hannan off the ball. Shane Hannan in the press gantry of the Majeski Stadium at the weekend, Reading being where Clive Tilsley lives. So that's how come he was knocking around there. So they had a big long chat. We're going to bring you the full chat at a later date where he talks about the 1999 season, the anniversary of which obviously is coming up. But first, we'll play you Clive here talking about how he always knew he wanted to be a football commentator.
Yes, I've been a saddo since quite a young age. Yeah, it's all I ever wanted to do. You know, my parents have reminded me of that throughout my career. And I've got two children in their 20s now, and they're not going to become commentators, but they have got the first foot on the first rung of career ladders that are passions for them. And to enjoy going to work every day is worth millions and millions of pounds.
Leaving college, it seemed to be, or university, it seemed to be quite a quick transition for you into Radio Trent, I think it was, in Nottingham.
The first break's always the biggest break. And I just happened to be completing an economics course at Nottingham University, only because there were very, very few media college courses at that time. At the same time as the commercial radio station Radio Trent was coming on air, so they had vacancies for three T-boys and two T-boys and a T-girl, as it was, and so I was actually offered the job about 3-4 weeks before I took my finals, which is why I only got a 2-2, obviously.
That's your excuse.
My son got a 2-1 and he kind of holds that against me. Yeah,
I've been reading, obviously, covering with Radio Trent in Nottingham in the mid-70s, you're kind of coinciding there with an era, I think, for us, perhaps a second division team at that stage. But a certain Brian Clough was the manager, and I think I recall hearing a story at one point of, was it a fashion lesson, perhaps, that Brian Clough gave you at one point?
Yeah, I mean, my first 4 or 5 years in radio, I covered Nottingham Forest home and away with Brian Clough as the manager. And then I moved to Merseyside, where Bill Shankly had a chat show. He was retired at the time on our radio program, and where I joined a golf club where Joe Mercer was a member. And I had a personal relationship with all three of those. Great is overused in sports broadcasting. These are three truly, truly great sportsmen. And you know, by whatever the parable is of David at the foot of the elders, that was me. I just spent so much time in the first 5 years of my career listening to these three men in particular, and then others around them. With Cluffy, in the 18 months that I spent in Nottingham, seeing him probably more days than not, because I literally covered Forest home and away, travelled with the team to games. He was a bit of a bully, which was not unusual for old school managers. He was drinking by then, and we all know that became an illness which affected him. But he was still, in his wonderfully instinctive management style, truly brilliant to be around. And once you'd served the initiation ceremonies, and I went through exactly the same thing with Sir Alec Ferguson. You know, once I've been bawled out a couple of times and bullied into getting to know the ropes, he became wonderfully loyal to me. And the first lesson that I received was the first time I travelled with the team on their train, or their private carriages on their train down to a game in London. And I was the first person to arrive half an hour before the train was due to depart. I thought I looked pretty smart. You know, my dad would kind of wear a double-breasted blazer and a button-down shirt and a nice pair of grey slacks, as we called them back then. And that's how I would dress for this very, very hot day, first day of the season. And Cluffy got on about 10 minutes before we were about to leave, and he said, young man, you're very welcome. to travel with the official Nottingham Forest party, but when you do travel with the official Nottingham Forest party, you do wear a tie. And I kind of went bright red and said, I'm very, very sorry indeed, Mr. Clough. I won't let this happen again. If, any other time, if you're invited me back, I'll definitely wear a tie. And he didn't move. He stood over me. He said, young man, you're very, very welcome to travel with a Nottingham. This happened three times. And eventually he put his hand in his pocket. He pulled out a 10 bob note, which will have lost half the audience straight away. It was 50p. But you could get a tie for 10 bob back then. And he said, the train leaves in 5 minutes. So I, fortunately, the central station in Nottingham, Midland station, was aptly named. And there was a gents outfitters just right out of the station who was only just opening. And I kind of threw the 10 bob note on him, stole a tie and ran back onto the train. And I was sweating profusely. It looked a real mess 10 minutes into the journey. And Clifford came past. He said, very smart, very smart. And I wore a tie. All the time, talking like him now, to every football match I attended professionally until 1994. So this was 1975. And in 1994, my opening game of the World Cup finals was in the Pasadena Rose Bowl, which was an open stadium. It was about 120 degrees in old money. And everybody else was in a tennis shirt or a T-shirt. And I still had a collar and tie on. And it was Barry Davis said, what on earth? I said, I told him the story. He says, he's gone. You can take it off. And I don't think I've worn a tie to a match since. Sorry, Brian.
Well, he set the precedent, I guess. He gave you a lesson. Of course, after your Nottingham tenure, then with Radio Trent, you moved to Radio City in Liverpool for quite a long stint there. I can't help but feel as obviously plenty of happy memories, I'm sure, during that time. But of course, there was the Heysel disaster and Hillsborough as well. But you were in the stadium in Brussels when the Heysel disaster happened. Obviously, 39 people killed and 600 injured as Liverpool played Juventus in the European Cup final. But that must have been quite a life-changing moment for you as well.
It was. It was exactly that. The timing of my move from Nottingham to Merseyside could hardly been better. I arrived in the spring of 1977 on Merseyside, just as Liverpool were going for the treble and just as they were about to win their first European Cup. I was 22 years of age. I was the same age as the players. It was in an era when the trust between football and its media was far stronger, an era before mobile phones and selfies. All of the players of Everton and Liverpool became my friends. They became some of my closest friends. If I wasn't travelling to games with them, and I travelled on the team coach with Everton and Liverpool when they were the best two teams in the country, maybe the world, you know, that's how close to the club, the two clubs that I became. And if I wasn't working with them, then I was going out to nightclubs with them. You know, they were my mates, and many of them are my mates to this day. You know, if I bump into Ronnie Whelan on the circuit, it's a hug. It's not a handshake. I mean, we kind of grew up together. He as a footballer, me as a commentator. That's how close Jim Beglin, who I've, you know, sort of been tied at the waist to for year after year after year as a co-commentator who came down with a terrible condition in Cape Town on the eve of a World Cup semi-final when I was with him. And these are, you know, I know Jim, I know Elaine, I know their two children. That's the bond that I've got. So to go through the experience of first Heysel and then Hillsborough, A, as a journalist, but B, as a friend of people who were most closely affected, was an extraordinary experience. And I don't, you know, God forbid I'm ever involved with anything remotely like that, but I don't think I would ever be as close to the eye of the storm, if you like, if it were to happen in the modern era. But everything has changed, you know, the whole coverage, the whole relationship between football and its public through the medium of its media has changed. Back then, I was almost one of the team.
Would it be fair to say, I mean, I've read somewhere over the years that you have kind of phased out the use of the word disaster or catastrophe or tragedy. If something like, for example, Loris Karius in the Champions League, which obviously an awful thing for Liverpool fans, but when put in perspective, is not that awful. I think I read that maybe the word calamity would perhaps be best used, but would that be inextricably linked to your experiences of Heysel and post Hillsborough as well, do you reckon?
It's certainly influenced by that. My great mentor in sport, who sadly is no longer with us, was Reg Guttridge, who was the boxing commentator on ITV. And Reg took a shine to me. He liked my attitude and my approach. I loved his company. Just a most remarkable man, incredibly humorous.
Fought in Normandy as well, didn't he, in World War II?
He did. There's the great story. You know, he had a wooden leg, and there's the great story about Joe Frazier, who he tricked by putting a fork into his leg just to show him how tough he was. And Joe Frazier, of course, you know what's coming. Here's the punchline. Said, hey, you've got to see this guy. You've got to see this guy. He's amazing. And, of course, he stuck it in the wrong leg. Joe Frazier took a fork and stuck it in the leg. So that's Reg's story anyway. But Reg gave me an education in communication, not in broadcasting, not in television, not in radio, but in how to communicate with people, about the responsibility that went with communication, the beauty of this language that we speak, and that, you know, commentators regularly crucify, and the importance of finding the right words at the right time, the importance of commentating to your grandma and not to the England coach, you know, of being inclusive as a broadcaster and not assuming. All of these things Reg taught me, not unlike Cluffy, with some fairly bullying phone calls from time to time. And this wasn't a specific lesson about tragedy and disaster, but it was a lesson that I kind of learned through finding the right, not being lazy with words. Great is a classic. I tend not to use the word great very often, because it's important. We all have a different definition of who and was great, but it certainly isn't a great free kick if it goes over the crossbar. You know, that's try to use the words well. And it's not always easy, because you're thinking out loud during the course of the narrative, the constant stream of consciousness of a commentary. But it's certainly, when you have seen a pile of, and it was a pile of dead bodies outside a stadium of people who had innocently gone to watch a football match, you realise that Loris Carrier spilling the ball is not a disaster.
Puts it all in perspective, for sure. You worked bits with Match of the Day as well in the early 90s, and I guess you've touched on the relationship between the media and managers and how it's kind of certainly changed over the years. Getting teams on days of matches and hours before, there was a great story. It involves a Holiday Inn and a fire alarm, something along those lines.
Yeah, I mean, you know, to this day, you have certain relationships with certain people who take you into their confidence. With, you know, team news is, we've seen with Marcelo Bielsa this season how precious, you know, team information, team tactical information is. But probably Sir Alec Ferguson was the person who got it. I mean, we're talking about an old school manager who remained great throughout his career because he moved with the times. And one of the things that Fergie kind of appreciated as Manchester United grew as a Champions League force and attracted audiences of 15, 20 million people on UK television, was that was his way of that was his means of communicating with so many people. And so he embraced television. He would do this interview at half-time in the tunnel, which was kind of unheard of before or since, because he wanted to communicate what he'd said to the... He felt that was important. You know, he wasn't being paid for that. That wasn't part of his duty. He did that because he got the power of television. And consequently, I inherited from the late, great Brian Moore, my predecessor, a relationship with Fergie, and he took me into his trust, and he would try to not only tell me who was going to start, but what he wanted to try to do in the course of the match, so that hopefully my commentary would reflect in some way what he was trying to do. Other managers were less forthcoming. George Graham, who has been a good pal down the years, I was trying to phone on the Friday before a Leeds United versus Arsenal match at Elland Road on the Saturday. And I made a succession of phone calls to his office to be told, he'll be with you in 5 minutes. He's just in a meeting. And then the third or fourth phone call, oh, I'm sorry, he's gone. He's got on the coach and gone. Now, that was all I could glean from Arsenal. But fortunately, another person who sadly is not with us anymore, David Rocastle, Rocky Rocastle, was my snout in the Leeds United camp. David was a friend, and he was one of those players who was prepared to let me in on what he knew. But that day when I phoned him on the Friday, he not only told me the Leeds team, he told me the Arsenal team too. And you can imagine how, of course, he'd got lots of mates who he'd left at Highbury, as it was then. And he told me what he knew about Leeds. And he said, you know Alan Smith's not playing, don't you? And I said, no, I didn't know that. I said, I just got told it was the same squad as last week. He said, no, Smudge has not travelled. He's picked up a groin strain in training. So I drive to Leeds, and I hadn't planned this, but as I drive into the car park of the Holiday Inn in Leeds, the Arsenal team bus is there. So I'm staying in the same hotel as Arsenal. So it's probably 9 o'clock, and I just have a bit of room service and go to sleep. Sure enough, 2 a.m. in the morning, alarms ring. So we all troop down into the car park. And all the Arsenal players are there in tracksuits, looking rather sort of dopey, having been dragged from their pits. And George is there, still looking magnificent in a collar and tie, been in the bar. And I sort of made eye contact with him, and he sort of looked at me, and he must have known I'd been trying to get him all day. And he sort of said, oh, sorry, I was really busy at lunchtime. I said, oh, it's no problem, George. I said, just a bit worried, you know, I can't see Alan Smith anywhere. And he looked at me, swore at me, and he said, who told you? And I said, sorry. So there you are. The people that he most wanted to keep the information that his top scorer was injured and hadn't travelled from were the only other people in the country. It wasn't in the newspaper that morning, but the only people who knew were Leeds United.
That's incredible. Well, one of the most famous commentary lines, I guess, occurred in 2002. It was a 16-year-old Wayne Rooney. I think he was earning £80 a week at the time, so he's come along quite a bit since then. But that moment, the remember the name Wayne Rooney line, I mean, it's an iconic line in football commentary now. But do you recall thinking about that line in advance? Is that something that's a spur of the moment? This kid has scored a screamer past David Seaman in the whatever minute of the game. He's only off the bench with 10 minutes to go, so it's clearly a massive moment in the Premier League. This is an Arsenal team with Vieira, Henry, Seaman, Cole, a massive team. Is that a moment you prepare for? Is that just a spur of the moment sentence almost?
Gravesen forward, Rooney, instant control, fancies his chances. Oh, brilliant goal! Impressive. The shot sensational. David Seaman's misery continues, but there was nothing that any goalkeeper could have done about that. Another Rooney record, and guess whose record he's broken? Michael Owen, that's who.
It was in the last minute, and they hadn't lost for a year, and then he nearly did it again in stoppage time. But the answer to your question, twofold. One, it's not cheating to prepare. Preparation, Brian Moore used to say to me, fail to prepare, prepare to fail. And preparation isn't just facts and figures. It is, I think, any good journalist prepares an intro for a story that they're going to cover ahead of, you know, and obviously that little section that we commentators do before a game, he or she has had some time to prepare some thoughts on what the team might be. That's where the manager's information helps you write it in advance to keep it as succinct as possible. So if you can prepare that, you can certainly prepare for the end of the game with different scenarios. Now, obviously, what you can't prepare for is what Wayne Rooney did, what Sheringham and Solskjaer did. That has to come off the top of your head because you can't anticipate that. But weirdly, because I spent so much time around Merseyside football, I had, a couple of weeks before that game, I'd been back on Merseyside attending a Graham Sharp testimonial occasion, hosting it, And this guy who I didn't know, an Everton fan, came up to me and said, have you heard about Rooney? And I had heard about Rooney because he'd been a sensation in the youth team and he was on the verge of the first team and people were kind of talking about him. But it was him that said, remember the name Wayne Rooney. So it came off the top of my head, except this guy whose name I don't know, it was a total steal from him. And the great part of the story was I attended another function about 3 or 4 months later, and he was quite a distinctive looking guy with a pointed beard and big glasses and hair swept back. And I saw him and I rushed across the room and said, hey, I know what you're going to say. He said, I'm going to tell you, his brother John is even better. And I saw him again at another function, like another few months later, and he said, I've got another one for you. And it's somebody else. I mean, bless him, John Rooney never quite made it. And this other guy never quite made it. So he rather tarnished his record. It's a little bit like, you know, the guy who told you about the Tiger, you know, 3 months before last year's National, but has given you 7 more tips since and none of them have come in. So he is responsible for remember the name Wayne Rooney, but he was also responsible for remember the name John Rooney. It doesn't quite work, that one, does it?
I guess in commentary as well, keeping it simple and not alienating people at home is another massive thing. I think, was it Kenneth Wolstenholme's line in 66, was they think it's all over. It is now such a simple line and yet iconic nowadays. But I think I've seen you talk about the Ron Seal advertisement on television, does exactly what it says in the tin. Very simple line, but gets to the point that people remember it. Is that something you think about? You don't want to alienate people listening with all these, I guess, words that require a dictionary.
Well, that is communication. That is what Reg Guttridge taught me. And listen, that in any kind of creative art, there is always room for an Oscar movie that you go to see and walk out after 15 minutes saying, sorry, just isn't getting me. It may well be the greatest film of the year, but it's not for me. And what Reg taught me more than anything is that when you have an audience, which you sometimes do have in terrestrial television, of 8, 10, 15, 28 million for the England World Cup semi-final just last year, you are now talking to people who are watching maybe their only football match. There is actually an argument for explaining the offside law at some stage during that commentary, because we've all been in that maths lesson at school where it's 30 minutes in, you're sitting at the back and you're thinking to yourself, I haven't understood a single word. Please don't ask me a question. And commentary, if I ever got criticised for explaining the away goal rule during a Champions League game, you know, sorry, if you know it, fine. But I'm talking to everybody else too, you know, and they might know it. And what's more, they may never have actually had the guts to ask. So rather like a good teacher, I think a good commentator welcomes you all in. And the great commentators have warmth, you know, they seem like people that you know, people that you would be able to sit down and have a jar with, you know. They're not people that necessarily confound you with a new word which you do have to look up. I sometimes read some of the great writers in The Guardian and so on, and you know, I see this stuff retweeted and, you know, this has got to the nub of Brexit. And, you know, we're in the fourth paragraph and I'm in the thesaurus for the 8th time here. I'm sorry, you're not getting to the nub of the Brexit, because Brexit has actually been voted for by people I disagreed with, but it's been voted for by really ordinary people. And by communicating in words that I don't understand and I'm damn sure they won't understand, you're not communicating at all. You're writing for yourself. And to commentate for yourself is actually the biggest crime. There is a responsibility that goes with broadcasting, and that responsibility is to communicate.
Even using little tricks like, I guess humour is one, repetition is another. I know even that Ryan Giggs header in one of the 3 All games, I think, in the group stage in 99, it was a header to match. Yes, a header to match from Ryan Giggs. I think, was it Ramos was booked in a Champions League final for goading Sadio Mane, or Sadio Mane got booked for being goaded by Ramos, and he said embarrassing twice. Little things like that. Repetition is obviously an important thing as well.
Yeah, I think the other side of the theory, the mantra, which I guess Reg and others have ingrained in me, is that I have never kicked a football properly in my life. Now, certainly in the early part of my career, I was particularly conscious of that. And, you know, there was a great sort of contest between John Watson and Barry Davis in the sort of late 80s and early 90s, which was actually quite a big thing in UK television, as who was going to be selected for the cup final, who was going to be. And you were either in one camp or the other. They weren't similar. I know them both very, very well, and I like them both very well, and I like them both as commentators, but they're different, and that is great. But Barry was that kind of commentator who would put a player down. And I occasionally had players come to me when I worked with him at the BBC. So just remind me how many caps Barry Davis has got, you know? And there is a kind of a feeling, you go down there, you try it, and then you can talk about it. But my first boss in television was a guy called the late Paul Docherty, who was the son of Peter Docherty, the very, very famous Manchester City Irish footballer. And he said, no, you're entitled to an opinion. You've got to qualify your opinion. You can't give an opinion out of experience because you haven't been down there, been there, seen it, done it. And that actually is what the co-commentator's role is. That's what the guy sitting alongside us, he's the guy, you know, he is Pheidippides. He's the guy who's been to the battlefield and has come back to Athens to tell us what it's like out there. We can't know. We've only got his account. But actually, by talking to people who've been there, seen it, done it for often enough and listening to them about, and then applying the knowledge that you gain to what you watch as a football game, of course you're entitled to express an opinion. And with that opinion, then you can express a certain emphasis. When you know that, you can see with your own eyes Sergio Ramos is cheating, trying to get an opponent booked or sent off, then I think it's just, I think it actually, that identification, that communication with the public, I think they're thinking the same. And I think at that moment, you shouldn't be frightened to say what you think they're thinking too.
I guess pauses and leaving lingering moments between certain lines adds a lot of effect as well. It kind of comes back to the TV and radio.
Maybe I just don't have anything to say.
But even, I was listening back last night to the obviously the 99 audio.
I think it's 8 seconds before I say something about the promised land.
Manchester United have reached the promised land.
Is this their moment? Beckham. Into Sheringham. And Solskjaer has won it! Manchester United have reached the promised land. The two substitutes have scored the two goals in stoppage time, and the treble looms large.
And that is thinking time, and that again has been given to me. The year before, I was working on the World Cup finals in France, and when Michael Owen scored against Argentina, I was watching at our sort of base, our studio in Paris, with about 20 other guys. Including Peter Drury, who's, you know, a colleague and friend. And when Owen scored and we all sat down again, I said to Peter Drury, I said, if we're ever lucky enough to get a moment like that, we've just learned one thing. You can say whatever you like for the next 20 seconds. Nobody's ever going to hear it. They're not listening. And actually, probably the best thing to do at those moments is say nothing. And just and particularly when the noise is loud. I think it's different with an away goal. I think there's a kind of a drop in the sound, you know, that just that distant bellow of 2,000 away fans in an 80,000 stadium. Your instincts tell you kind of need to fill that gap more. But when the place just takes off, you don't need to say anything. People, it's a visual medium. You know, what's the biggest difference between radio and television commentary? TV, you're not as important. You're just nothing like as important. And you've got to get over that. There's no point in trying to become important because they'll just turn you down. They can still watch it. You know, they don't need you. Radio, they need you. So if they don't need you for those 8 seconds, you owe it to them. And this is where somebody like Reg would come in to think what you're going to say. Reg said, you've now got to write the morning newspaper headline. That the next thing you say has got to be the morning. It's got to somehow capture. You're a journalist, he used to say. You're a broadcast journalist. Think editorially. He said, if anything is in the morning newspapers, which you haven't covered in the game, you haven't covered the game properly. You've got first shot at writing the story, at weighing it up as it goes along, and what it means to the people who are watching, the significance of it. And yeah, name on the trophy was kind of cute, because it felt, the whole season felt like, and so it is written, somehow it felt like that. But Solskjaer has won it. Was great because I got the right player. You know, if I'd shouted and Johnsen has won it, it wouldn't be quite so good. So I'd done my job in terms of I'd identified it. I had broken the biggest, I committed the biggest cardinal sin of commentary, by the way, in so much that I had heralded the winner before Devon Lock had actually reached the line, and if Bayern had equalised and it had gone into extra time and they'd won on penalties, I would probably never have worked again for, and Solskjaer has won it. But I got away with that, and having, you know, got away with that, if you like, then I was owed almost, you thinking, what Reg, yeah, I'm now talking to Reg. I'm not talking to you other 20 million. I'm trying to come up with a line here for Reg, which will capture this moment. And they, yeah, that was it. That was, you know, the waves had somehow parted and something had led them through them to this green and promised land. You know, you can't beat this.
One aspect of the world of broadcast journalism that I guess you wouldn't have foreseen when you started out is the dawn of video games. And I know since, it could be 2006 or the mid noughties, you've been working with EA Sports and FIFA, lending your voice to the FIFA PlayStation and Xbox games. It could be a very boring process, but I'm intrigued as to what that process is. There's obviously certain lines that you have to perhaps read and read again and read again, but what is that, just a case of sitting in the room and giving a script and sitting there for hours on end, or what is that process like?
Well, when I took over the mantle from John Motson at EA Sports, the biggest break I had was that I had a young son who played the games. And at that time, I could play them with him. I can't play them against him now. There's no point in me even plugging in. But I understood better than John the reach of this product. And during the time that I spent with EA, I mean, they were locked in a battle at the time with Pro Evo, but it was a battle they won. They won it partly on rights because they had the real teams and the real players, and they won it because their gameplay improved during that spell. But the other aspect that needed to improve was the soundtrack. The commentary that I inherited was written by Canadians in Vancouver. It's made in Vancouver, the game. And I mean, I'm sure there was goldminder and goaltender in there somewhere. And whereas John, here I'm putting down one of the greats now, I'd kind of taken the money and read it. It's my son. I didn't want my son to hear. I didn't want to hear that in the house because we were going to be playing FIFA. So I wanted to get it right, and I convinced them that I actually went to Vancouver and gave a couple of seminars on, really, I guess what Reg had taught me, that this is just the soundtrack. It's really not that important, as long as it's okay, as long as it's credible, as long as it's authentic. It will be fine. But if there is a line in there that he burst the onion bag, okay, somebody might chuckle at it once. But these guys are playing 8 games in an hour, and the fourth time they hear burst the onion bag in 20 minutes, it really isn't going to work. So you've got to pull the commentary back, make the commentary less of the entertainment, make the commentary the background music. I often say that if you walk into an Italian restaurant and there's Italian music playing in the background, you don't notice it. If they started playing Japanese music, it would actually spoil your meal. You'd think, whoa, wait a minute. And the commentator is kind of that. I mean, you've got to add a little bit more to that. But actually, you're not as important as the pictures. And the same is true when you're playing the video game. So there has certainly been a period in my career where I think my reach to an audience has been as great as the main voice on FIFA, which I'm no longer. Martin has taken over that from me, than it was on any sort of television coverage. FIFA is just massive in people's lives. I think I was probably the first voice of FIFA that recognised that and actually tried to become a part of the team to make the product better. And so I wrote the entire script. And how do you write a FIFA script? They give you, it's a little bit like a family tree. You start with a corner kick, and then there's a good corner and bad corner, and then there's good high corner and good low driven corner, and then these things build out. And as each line, as you imagine each line, corner then, you've got to find 20 different ways of saying corner. It's a corner. It's going to have to be a corner. And I think it's going to give a corner and all that. And then you write 20 versions of each of the derivatives of the corner. Or it's not a very good corner. Oh, he won't be happy with it. All of those you've got to write. And then somehow the AI joins them all together.
So, Clive, obviously, in the last number of weeks, the scourge of racism in football has reared its head once again. And I know you were on commentary duty for the Montenegro-England match at which Raheem Sterling and Danny Rose were subjected to horrific racial abuse, which clearly has no place in the game or in any sphere of society, really. I know you spoke at a Kick It Out conference as well in advance of that game. But one of the quotes I had written down from your conference itself, the seminar, the Kick It Out seminar, it's an area laced with unconscious preconceptions and ingrained favouritism. It's infected by lazy associations, institutionalised bias and subliminal stereotypes. Long words, no short answers. But is there a way to stamp this out of the game, to stamp it out of society? This is clearly something that, well, you witnessed firsthand in Montenegro, but it's a scary aspect of sport today.
I didn't witness it firsthand, sadly. I didn't hear it during the course of the commentary, and so I didn't know that it happened, so I wasn't in a position to condemn it, and so consequently I had to deal with certain accusations on social media the next day that I had ignored it. I'd suspected it because of Raheem's reaction to the goal, and I did mention my suspicions, but I didn't know. And as a journalist, I it's far too sensitive an issue to speculate beyond what I did. It's never gone away. The good news about the publicity and the incidents that are being reported are that it is being reported. And with any kind of abuse, domestic abuse, child abuse, the very word, in its purest definition, is a terrifying thing that we as human beings choose to use our power over either another human being or an animal or. Abuse is there's a word that should never be used idly or lightly. And can it be stamped out? Or how do you stamp it out? You educate people. You make them realise that abuse is wrong. That is very much more easily said than done. All that lazy or unwitting racism is the racism of people who don't realise they're racist. Many of them don't want to be racists. We all have prejudices in our life, all of us. Football amplifies those prejudices. We, even sometimes standing on a touchline watching our own children play any sport, will either mutter or, worse still, openly criticise the referee. We may even do it by way of some misguided sense of banter. It doesn't sound like banter to the referee. Believe me, it sounds like abuse, and it certainly doesn't help he or she do their job any better. And one of the recurring themes, I think, of the public instances of the instances of racism that have been publicised is almost a sense that it is a bit of a laugh, that there is, the guy who ran on and attacked Lee Hendry in the Birmingham Derby and being cheered by 100 or more people, it's all right. He's a millionaire. I didn't hurt him. It's not all right. It's really not all right. And the four guys who stood at the front there and shouted at Raheem Sterling, whatever they shouted at him, whatever it was, it's abuse and it's wrong. And and somehow football stirs us up into being people that we're not. And actually what I would love to do as part of the Kick It Out organisation, there have to be sanctions. There have to be deterrents if they work. I'm not absolutely convinced that docking points is going to get to the heart of it. But what I'd really love to do is get one of those four guys and turn them. I'd love to get one of those four guys to come out and say, do you know what, until I saw myself doing what I was doing, I didn't realise I was doing it. And we've all been there. We've had a few too many drinks, or we're trying to stop smoking, or trying to stop swearing, or trying to be nicer to people. We all need some help with this stuff. And even though some of these people are beyond help, and some of these people are beyond sympathy, and some of these people need the full weight of the law to come crashing down on them and to be punished, a lot of them just need a bit more help. We all need a little bit more help understanding. You're from an island where, you know, I mean, the rest of the world is standing back looking at the UK at the moment and thinking, what on earth are you doing? You know, there have been times when a lot of people have stood back and looked at the island of Ireland and thought, what the heck are you doing? You know, why can't you see it from a... We all need to somehow take a step back, be that guy who sees himself, sees his misbehavior, sees his irrational, stupid, idiotic behavior, and how hurtful and how spiteful it is. And hopefully, if you can turn a mirror on yourself and start to correct it yourself, or correct it with the help of people around you, that's how we get to the bottom of it.
You mentioned Ireland there, and I know, speaking to you before we started the interview, Ireland is a country where, well, you spend a lot of time for playing golf as well, but...
You've got all my golf balls!
But you have different stories, even from earlier in your journalism career. You spent time in Ballybuffet, of all places, as well.
Oh, wow, that was a long time ago. I think probably the first time I worked on a game in Ireland was, I want to say, about 1978. It was Finn Harps versus Everton in, I guess, the UEFA Cup. Must have been. I know that I flew with the official Everton party. I was working for the radio station in Merseyside. I know that we flew to Dublin because the advice was not to fly to Belfast at the time. And in 1978, it's a four-day hike from Dublin to Ballybuffet, by the way. There was a lovely guy who a lot of your listeners will remember, Fran Fields, who was a big man in Irish football, but he was Mr. Ballybuffet, and he met us at the airport in Dublin. And I in the pre World Wide Web days could only glean as much information as I could on Finn Harps, and he said, "Don't worry, you sit next to me." And I'd spend about 2 hours of the trip sitting next to Fran, and he took me through every player in the squad, he took me through the club's achievements, and it was just absolute gold dust. So that by the time we arrived at the hotel, I knew everything that I could possibly need to know for the game the next day. And I went down early to the, I think Stadium might be pushing it, to the venue, and actually there were Everton fans helping mark the lines out and everything. I remember it was a fantastic feel, and a lovely sort of communion of football kind of feel before the game. And there was a journalist who covered Finn Harps regularly who came and introduced himself to me, and he said, "Can I help with anything?" And I said, "Well, fortunately, I sat next to Fran all the way up here, and he's filled me in on everything." And he said, "What's he told you?" I said, "Well, the striker." I said, "I didn't realise he'd been in the Irish squad." He said, "He's not. He's not been in the Irish squad. He was in the under-16 squad about 8 years ago." He said, "He's never been anywhere near." I said, "Well, what about the left back? Because I'm right in saying both United and City are looking." "No." He said, "No, Swindon, I've asked him for a trial." And Fran had actually given me his version of the Finn Harps team, which was lovely and romantic and wasn't too far removed from the truth, but actually was fanciful by half. And so if I ever found my notes for that game, there were quite a lot of crossings out before kickoff. But it was kind of the... I hope that's not a stereotype, but it kind of gave a flavour of Finn Harps versus Everton back then, and Everton won the game pretty comfortably. And I should say, and Sean Cox's charity, there is a good man who I've never met in my life before, but an ordinary football fan who cares as much about his football as I do, who went to a football match and nearly didn't come back, and whose life has been changed just by innocently by going to a football match and coming back. That is the complete antipathy, the complete opposite of what I do. I just go to football matches and live this dream. And he went to a football match and I was bound to come up with a cliche. Has had an absolute nightmare, which is enduring. And anything we can do to help him get back to where he was when he set off to Anfield that day. Please, please don't forget Sean. Please, please do everything you can in Ireland to support and help Sean get back to where he needs to be.
Off the Ball.
Find us on Twitter at Off the Ball.
News Talk 106 to 108.